Hello and welcome to Indie Film Weekly, a No Film School podcast. I'm John Fusco, a producer at No Film School.
And I'm Emily Buter, managing editor of No Film School.
It is June 2nd, 2016, and on today's show, it's been a very contentious week for film as something is making indie producers in California very angry. People are also angry at Katie Couric, but for very different reasons, and also some wisdom from Steven Spielberg.
And as always, news you can use about gear, upcoming deadlines, and new film releases. And, of course, Ask No Film School.
Okay, we're live from downtown Brooklyn, New York. As always, we're going to be bringing you everything you might have missed this week while you're busy working on all your film projects, you lucky listeners. This week, the parents are gone, so it's just me and Emily, and we're taking over the show with a sort of youthful vigor. Ryan is still off working on his debut feature, Amateur, and Liz is in Portland, Seattle. She's in the Pacific Northwest somewhere, and she's meeting with some of our other writers, and that's left me and Emily alone here. So, Emily, hit us with some of your favorite news stories from this week.
Well, I like this one because John and I are both from California, so it hits close to home. Indie producers in California are very unhappy with the state tax incentive program, which in recent years has turned to favor bigger budget productions over indie films. This means that the bulk of the money is being allocated to studios and television productions, and oftentimes from out of state rather than California's burgeoning indie film market.
Is there much of a, is it a burgeoning sort of indie film market out there, or is California mostly dedicated to sort of like these studio, hasn't it always sort of been dedicated towards studio productions?
Okay, let's back up a second. Here's what happened. Until a year ago, the state held a lottery to allocate the funds. Indie film producers were guaranteed at least 10% of the $100 million tax incentive budget. But as luck would have it, they often wound up getting more than that. In 2013, they got $17.5 million. But now that the lottery's been scrapped, only 9% of projects that were selected for the funds were actually indie projects. And in total, $223 million went to non-indie film and TV producers. So the argument here is that giving money to bigger productions creates more jobs. That's why the state endorses it. But I believe there has to be some sort of middle ground. Creating jobs and incentivizing indie production in California can't be mutually exclusive endeavors. So what if the Film Commission were to allocate a specific budget to a larger number of indie-only productions? Do you think that would work, John?
I think maybe if they were going to be maybe putting together a whole separate grant for that, or some sort of whole separate category for tax incentives for independent films, that could solve the problem. But then it's like, you know, how much can they actually afford to give to both the big studio features and the indie features?
It seems sort of unfair because really indies are the one who need the money.
Yeah.
If you think about it, last year the most amount of money that was awarded to a single project was $26 million. And that money went towards Teen Wolf, the non-indie MTV series. And you would think that they don't need that extra help.
No, I mean, if they have a huge corporation sort of backing them, it doesn't really make a lot of sense that the government would be getting involved.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand why producers are angry, because tax incentives are historically very crucial to productions outside of the studio system. So if this very large amount of money is suddenly being cordoned off to studios, it kind of restricts the amount of indie.
Well, it seems like, you know, states also use this as a way to make an incentive for filmmakers to come into their states and film movies. But does California really, like, need to be doing that? You know what I mean? Like, it makes sense, I guess, that, you know, like, New Mexico would have incentives for independent filmmakers to try and build up, like, burgeoning film scenes there. But it kind of gets back to the point where, is California now just a studio machine? You know what I mean? Are most of the movies there
Hollywood anyway?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
Well, I guess California doesn't need independent film. So what else are people angry about?
Well, documentary ethics are once again at the forefront. Remember that Vax scandal? That was a big one.
Yeah, Robert De Niro selected a movie about anti-vaccination to screen at Tribeca Film Festival, and obviously it created an uproar among the general public, and people are like, what is Robert De Niro thinking about?
Yeah, and this scandal more pertains to editing, which is interesting because obviously documentary is subjective, but let's take this case as an example. Katie Couric and Stephanie Sochig's new anti-gun doc, Under the Gun, has come under fire for an allegedly misleading editing choice. In one scene, Couric asked members of the Virginia Citizens Defense League a question. She asked them, if there are no background checks for gun purchasers, how do you prevent felons or terrorists from purchasing a gun? In the movie, her question was met with blank stares and an 8-second silence. But here's the catch. The conservative site Amaland acquired the original audio from the meeting, and that seems to indicate that there was no pause at all, and that the group responded to Couric's question without hesitation. This is obviously very problematic, and there have been many public statements issued since this came out. In one statement, Sochig, the director, said, "There are a wide range of views expressed in the film. My intention was to provide a pause for the viewer to have a moment to consider this important question before presenting the facts on Americans' opinions on background checks. I never intended to make anyone look bad, and I apologize if anyone felt that way." If Katie Couric is showing us what we shouldn't do in documentaries, Steven Spielberg was at Harvard last week to tell us all what we should do in life and in movie making. He started his Harvard graduation speech by saying, "When I was 12 years old, my father handed me a movie camera. It was the tool that allowed me to make sense of this world." Spielberg actually dropped out of college himself to go work at Universal Pictures, but he went back to graduate later. Speaking to the graduates, he said that they faced a momentous responsibility, not unlike when Star Wars The Force Awakens Rey realizes the Force is with her. "What you choose to do next is what we call in the movies the character-defining moment," he said. "But in a 2-hour movie, you get a handful of character-defining moments. But in real life, you face them every day. Life is one string of character-defining moments." One of those for Spielberg himself was in the 80s, after he had made some self-described celluloid bubble films, which is to say they were very much within the realm of his own experience and perspective. He branched out and decided to make the color purple. It showed him how movies could inspire empathy and in turn provoke social growth and change. He said, "While making that film, I realized a movie could also be a mission. Don't turn away from what's painful. Examine it. Challenge it."
And you can watch that full commencement on our site right now. One particular passage that struck me from the commencement speech was how he talked about when he was 25, he recognized the importance of listening to his inner voice or his intuition, and then he went on to go and define sort of the difference between intuition and conscience. He said, "I want to be clear that your intuition is different from your conscience. Your conscience shouts, 'Here's what you should do,' while your intuition whispers, 'Hear what you could do.' Listen to that. Nothing will define your character more." So he made that decision when he was 25. And that was kind of interesting to me because I don't know, I guess I thought that he started from a younger age to sort of, you think that legendary filmmakers like that would have it sort of all figured out from the get-go, you know? But this is a guy who dropped out of college, spent, I don't know, 6 years in the studio system before he actually started making the things that he...
He found his voice.
Yeah, he found his voice and he found, I mean, he has one of the most boundless imaginations out of any filmmaker out of the past 50 years. I mean, the stories that he's come up with sound crazy, but he went for them. And that really struck a chord with me because just having faith in those ideas that you have and going out and pursuing them, even if it doesn't seem like it's the safe choice, seems like the right thing to do, and it's good that, you know, we can get that sort of gratification from a great mind like him.
Yeah, and he said once he started paying attention to what direction he was feeling pulled in, which oftentimes were the more painful stories to examine, that he would find himself choosing different kinds of scripts to attach himself to. So it makes sense that he would go on to direct Schindler's List.
And as he got older, too, you know, started off with like Jaws and E.T. and all that Amblin stuff. And then as his interests developed or as his sense of responsibility as a filmmaker shifted, then he got into the deeper stuff too. So I'm just going to say to conclude that sort of thought that while you are, you know, keeping yourself afloat by whatever means you can, whatever day jobs or sort of pursuits you've taken on to, you know, live and pay the bills, just keep listening and eventually just go for it. So while we're having this conversation sort of about what it takes to be a filmmaker, let's head into some gear news. We've made a lot about sort of the potential of VR over the past year, and how there's sort of an easy break-in point for filmmakers to be entering into that medium because there just hasn't been that much content put out for VR yet, and we still don't even really know what the best way to use VR is. But Vitrima has made it even easier for low-budget filmmakers now to jump into that game. They've unveiled a lens for the GoPro that allows users to record in stereoscopic 3D, and it only costs $50.
That's insane.
Yeah. Any lens going for $50 is nuts, but one that sort of has the potential to revolutionize an industry, but certainly make it more
accessible
to young filmmakers is really, and old filmmakers, whatever, emerging filmmakers, is a really incredible opportunity. So in case, just like as a way to define what stereoscopic 3D is for people who don't know, is it's the attempt to reproduce the process by which we see with our own eyes in order to produce a feeling of depth. So it's for shooting 3D, and to achieve this, two cameras are used to capture separate images of the same object from slightly different angles, but from one fixed viewpoint. So if you're putting your phone into a Google Cardboard piece, you'll see two images side by side. One will be slightly different from the other, but it almost will be unrecognizable.
It accounts for the space between your eyes.
Right, exactly. So the lens uses mirrors to capture the two left-right images, and there's no stitching required later on. It does it automatically for you. It also doesn't require any software and is immediately viewable through a VR headset, which means there's no editing required at all.
Whereas before, you know, before meaning... Well,
before this,
I mean, whereas it used to take,
well, stitching in general used to be like a huge problem just because it took so long to do, and it's inaccurate
a lot of the time.
Yeah, and it's inaccurate a lot of the time. So, I mean, we're just finding easier and easier ways to make this technology possible. The product hasn't quite launched yet, but you can sign up to get notified when they become available. That link will be on the accompanying article for this podcast, and you can also check out videos to see how it works and see how the footage looks as well. Speaking about making things more accessible for filmmakers, Xiaomi? I'm going to say Xiaomi has unveiled a new drone called the Mi Drone, which it shoots in 4K RAW. And it's only $460. This is going to make it one of the most inexpensive drones among any of your options out there today. They're offering two versions, the $460 4K model, which I just mentioned, and they're also going to be releasing a $380 1080p model. But if you compare these price tags to their biggest rival, which is DJI, the Mi drone is cheaper than the 4K and 2.7K models of the Phantom 3, which are $650 and $500 respectively. Some of the cool features about this drone are that it has a four-propeller system with detachable shields. It can fly for 27 minutes nonstop. As I mentioned, it can shoot in 4K with a 104-degree wide-angle lens. It can shoot 720p live video with low latency from up to 2 kilometers distance. The camera is attached to a 3-axis gimbal. It has GPS and vision-based positioning for maximum precision. And it's got some cool autopilot options as well. It has automatic takeoff and landing, waypoint flight path planning. There will be a map on the drone that you can tap to map your flight path. And you can circle an object on the ground. That's all autopilot. It intelligently detects if you're running low on battery, and then it will return home to you automatically. And there's location tracking for easy retrieval, even after maybe you crashed it. And it will automatically stop at the edge of no-fly zones, which is pretty cool.
Something about this reminds me of a pet.
That does not surprise me. So Xiaomi says that they'll be showing us their 4K model of the drone sometime at the end of July. It will be entering public beta, while the 1080p model is going to be running a crowdfunding campaign later on. So it's not exactly available yet, but it's definitely something to keep an eye out for. Okay, so now let's move on to festival and grant deadlines that you guys should be paying attention to. We've mentioned this before, but POV, their call for entries is ending June 15th. And when I say ending, I mean it's got to be at PBS by June 15th, not postmarked June 15th. To remind you of what POV is, it's for both U.S. and international filmmakers. It's known as the best of American public television's showcase of independent documentaries. And if your project is chosen, it'll be put in a slate with some of the best work from around the world for PBS's 2017 broadcast series. You can check out some of the past entries and winners right now in an article we released earlier this week, and we'll link to that in the post.
We've also got an early bird deadline for the Woman in Film / the Screening Room Finishing Fund. That is June 14th. The Woman in Film Foundation Finishing Fund, WIFFFFFF.
WIFFFFFF.
Woof. Supports films by or about women by providing cash grants of up to $15,000 and in-kind services. To be eligible for the grant, you must have completed at least 90% of principal photography and have a rough cut at the same time of the application.
And in the world of festivals, if you're looking for a festival to submit your project to but have been very worried it won't fit into any category, then the LA Indie Film Fest is the festival for you. There are 8 award categories for feature films and 17 award categories for all films under 30 minutes. It's also a screenplay competition, so if you want to submit your screenplay, you can win an award for Best Feature, Best Short, or Best TV Pilot. The feature gets $1,000 and 2 VIP passes, and the short and TV pilot winners each get $250 and 2 VIP passes to the festival. So submit your film or screenplay to the LA Indie Film Festival by June 3rd.
And the Great Lakes International Film Festival has a deadline coming up on June 4th. If you're a Film Freeway member, they're also offering a special discount on submission fees. Speaking of unusual categories, they also offer subgenre awards for horror movies like supernatural, thrillers, Wiccan, magical, and slashers.
Very specific categories for horror. I would actually be pretty interested in seeing what those entries are.
Me too. My interest is piqued.
And from September 22nd through October 1st, they actually hold an online festival, so we'll actually be able to check out some of the nominees for those categories. Right here in New York, we have the second year of the Young Filmmakers series taking place. Early deadline is June 6th. The screenings happen at Anthology Film Archives, which is a really cool New York venue. The promoters make sure to point out that the Anthology Archives have a real screen made out of French glass and that they screen DCPs from a real cinema projector. So it's called Young Filmmakers for a reason. It's a student-based film festival, and it's open to students in middle, high school, and college. And I think that the best part about this film festival is that there's a nice community aspect to it. So if you are a young filmmaker, it gives you a chance to get together with your peers, start to network, learn from each other, and of course, get down, boogie to the jams. They also continue to promote your stuff online even when the screening is done. So if you're a young filmmaker, definitely check this out. It's a good way to see what the New York film scene can be like.
And on a much bigger scale, we've got the San Diego International Film Festival with a late deadline of June 10th. It's a competitive 5-day festival for U.S. and international independent films and filmmakers. The cool thing about this festival is that it is a launching pad for films that go on to win major awards, like, for example, The Silver Linings Playbook, 12 Years a Slave, and The Imitation Game. So if you think you can play with the big dogs, this would be a good one to enter.
Yeah, those are some big dogs.
Yep.
If you're trying to beat the heat this week and are just staying inside and pumping your air conditioning all the way up, then here are some movie releases that you should check out while you're doing nothing.
Well, you might as well do that in a theater.
you might as well do that in theater. We'll get to that later, though. Coming straight to video on demand on Tuesday, June 7th, you can rent Lenny Cook, which is a documentary about 2001's most hyped high school basketball player in the country. He ranked above LeBron James, Amari Stoudemire, and Carmelo Anthony, but a decade later, he still hasn't played a single minute in the NBA. What's really exciting about this documentary is that it's the debut documentary film entry from heaven knows what directors Joshua and Benny Safdie. And Emily loves that movie. Emily, what do you got for us?
Yeah, it's interesting because they are known for filming their narrative films a lot like documentaries. They pick up people from the street and make them actors. And they did that for their last film, Heaven Knows What. The actress, what's her name? Ariel.
She wrote
Holmes.
It though,
right? Ariel Holmes. She did.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting for me to see what they can do with real life.
Speaking about biopics, there's a couple coming out on Amazon Prime Instant this week. On June 2nd, you can check out The Program, which stars Ben Foster as Lance Armstrong and Chris O'Dowd as the Irish sports journalist who tried to expose him for steroids abuse. And you can also check out one of my favorites. Yeah, I'd say it's one of my favorites. You can also check out one of my favorites from last year, Love and Mercy. If you haven't heard about it, both John Cusack and Paul Dano play Brian Wilson in this, and it kind of jumps around his timeline. So Dano is playing the young Brian Wilson, Cusack is playing the older Brian Wilson. It's a must-see for all Beach Boys fans, and it's one of the better biopics to have come out in recent memory, I think. On Netflix, we were talking about Spielberg earlier. You can now stream every Jurassic Park movie except for Jurassic World. So if you like dinosaurs and you haven't seen Jurassic Park,
what are you doing?
Go watch them now.
In limited release theatrical, we've got a Sundance favorite from this past year. It's the debut feature from a director called Anna Rose Holmer, about an 11-year-old tomboy who becomes entranced with a dance troupe. And as she struggles to fit in, she finds herself caught up in a very bizarre situation in which the group begins to suffer from fainting spells and other violent fits. Apparently, I haven't seen it, I'm seeing it this weekend, but apparently it's a very strong first film and it has a very specific voice and style.
Well, it was a selection of the Venice Bernal College Cinema 2014-2015 section, and it was a part of the Sundance Institute's Editing Intensive Fellowship, so it's got some
accolades.
Yeah, behind it. And if you're in LA, you can look out for the world premiere of The Breakout, which is going to be at Dances with Films Festival. It's takes place at the Chinese Theater in Hollywood.
It's an indie musical. I don't know what that means, but I would like to know.
It's interesting sounding, and our editor-in-chief, Liz Nord, has an interview with the director of that coming out on No Film School later this week. So
I guess we'll find out a little bit more.
Yeah. We've been really enjoying answering some of your questions or some of the questions we found on the boards in these episodes, and this week is going to be no exception.
David Dearlove.
Cool name.
Yep, that's true. Props for the
not
name.
D-E-R-L-O-V-E, not Dearlove, D-E-A-R-L-O-V-E.
David Dearlove wants to know how to avoid people whose attitudes absolutely suck. He says, no matter how polite or humble you try to be, some people's attitudes are terrible. How do you deal with this?
First of all, David, stupid question. What's wrong with you? No, we're just kidding.
I think it's important to remember, if a crew member starts giving you attitude, it's important to remind everybody of the common goal of a film, which is you're all there for the same reason, to make one project. So egos, you know, come and go, but if you can try to unite people and get them on the same page, they stop thinking as much about their own petty complaints and begin sort of taking a larger perspective.
Yeah, and I think along those lines, the more you sort of seem confident in your own vision and the more you push your own vision and the more you make it known that you are the person in charge of your vision, I think the more people will notice that about you, and then they'll start having more confidence in you too, and they'll go along with what you're saying instead of like chiming in with their own opinions and sort of like feeling that they have the authority to
override you.
Yeah, because it's your project, it's your vision ultimately, and there's something to be said for collaboration too, which is what I think Emily was talking about. And the more you can like keep people on your side, or like at least clue them into this thing that you're all building together, but while still sort of maintaining the fact that it is your vision, I think that's really important. And I think that if you're dealing with bad attitudes in that sort of way, where people are questioning, you know, your vision, that should be where you start. One reader replied to this post with a motto that they say in France, which is be nice with stupid people and they will take advantage of you. Be rude with them and they will respect you, which is not something that I totally agree with. You shouldn't really be trying to instigate anything, I think, with your crew. But I think don't just like be a pushover about it. You really can't just be nice to like these people. You got to be like less than rude. You have to be, again, like more authoritative and in control.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I was speaking to a lot of directors at Cannes a couple weeks ago, they kept mentioning the fact that their sets felt like families. Mm-hmm. And that was the most important element of to the success of their project. And that really struck me. Not everybody can say that for their crew. And the more you can create that kind of environment, the less of these problems you're going to have.
Yeah, so maybe when you
fewer of these problems you're going to have.
Right. And like if you go into it with that sort of mindset when you're casting or when you're, you know, choosing your crew, that could probably be very invaluable. If this is a problem that keeps coming up, you should find the people that are your family and that you can make films with comfortably and that will collaborate with you instead of questioning your every move or giving you negative comments without sort of providing any sort of constructive feedback. All right, that about wraps up this week's show. You can read about all the news you've heard on the accompanying article with this, and be sure to check out more on nofilmschool.com.
Thank you so much for listening.
Once again, I'm John Fusco. You can follow me at Jim_John_Jim on Twitter.
I'm Emily Booter, and you can follow me at EL Booter.
Not as cool of a Twitter name.
Definitely not.
Mine. I got underscores. Please remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes, and we will see you next week.